and welcome to Unidentified Wargamer. Each week I interview a wargamer and identify them in the hobby. This week I've got on the famous Michael Clark. How are you going?
Good, mate. Good. Thanks for having me on the show, Sam.
Oh, no worries. Thanks for making time on your busy schedule. I know you're a pretty busy cricketer, so it's nice to have you come on the podcast and chat with me.
Retirement's good. Retirement's
good. How's your week been treating you? I know it's just started, but how was your first day back at work?
Oh, I only just started, and daylight savings is wrecking me. You wake up a bit earlier, and then you're still working just as late anyway, and then you end up getting your times wrong and 15 minutes late to the show you're booked in for, because Queenslanders don't use daylight savings apparently. So
yeah, if only you work part of Queensland, we never change the clocks anywhere, so we're fine. We're always good to go.
Look, I did hear that that apparently I don't know, daylight savings like fades the kerns or disrupts the cows and whatever. So
yeah. Who knows what these farmers come up with?
Lived in Queensland for a few years, and the bit that I didn't get was the whole 3:45 a.m. when the sun gets up. I don't know.
The sun's always the same, like not the same time, but the sun's always like there. Like it doesn't matter what time it is. The farmers still got to go to work when the sun gets up because the animals are still good to go.
Yeah.
What's been on your hobby table these past few weeks?
Not that much. Flicking between a few different armies for both Masters and Worlds, which we'll chat later on, and not that much needed on the hobby table. Got most of what I've got ready or available as borrow in local clubs and whatnot. So I think at the moment there's a couple of half-built Chaos Knights from Slaves and a few other bits and bobs from Slaves to Darkness to fill out. Slaves has like Slaves and then Associated Allies and Coalition in Chaos has endless options, so basically never stop. You never stop. There's always something further to build and paint, but not that much on the hobby recently.
Are you much of a hobbyist? Is that sort of part of your hobby, is doing like painting models and building and stuff like that?
Yeah, definitely. I've probably been a little bit less so recently, but I very much got into the hobby as a hobbyist first, and then played a few games. I went to an event or two and sort of realised I was okay at the game side as well. I've probably been more of a competitive gamer in terms of the tilt of effort and thought over the last couple of years. But try and view myself as a holistic approach to the hobby. It's very attractive. I like the lore. I have to admit, I like the 40K law a little bit more than the AOS law, but just from the depth and history. I like the AOS game and community a lot better than the 40K game and community. but the lore, the stories, the visuals, the hobby element, the painting, the creativity. I love conversions. Got some pretty mega conversions for. Had to prepare myself a bit more in time, I would have brought up a few of my favourites. And then, of course, the gaming and understanding the meta and keeping at that sort of cutting edge of the meta and the competitive side. But, bit of try and be a holistic on it. But I do admit last kind of 12, 18, probably 24 months, I've been skewed to the competitive gaming side more than the hobby side.
Okay, fair enough. And do you have a leaning? Are you like part of the order, or are you destruction, chaos? What's your leaning for army styles?
I'm all round. I've actually got a lot of everything. I think I started with order. I had when I first got back into the hobby, it was the Isle of Blood High Elf starter set from 2015 or something. I had lying around and just started sort of painting them as a bit of something to do, and then felt a need for that creativity side, and then an ad popped up on Facebook around people calling for any Warhammer gamers locally in Geelong, and I was like, why not? I'll just rock up and see who these people are, and it was all go from there.
What draws you towards the elves, or what did at the start to sort of keep you in?
I actually think it was a bit of the hobby side. The elves are just, you need that detail to paint them, and there's Even the starter box cheap to collect elves have incredible levels of detail to them. And painting that, you don't really need any special skills to paint elves.
just patience, I suppose.
You pretty much just need patience and it's color by numbers. Just keep the colors within the lines is all you need to do with a fine hand. But yeah, I don't know. Order was that start, and I've got a huge order army with most of the allegiances in there. Also got a huge chaos army. Competitive wise, I like soup armies. So Cities of Sigma and Slaves to Darkness are two of my kind of core main armies. But I also have three or four destruction factions and a feck army for death.
Nice. So how many armies would you have all up then, you reckon?
I think I've got playable, like full 2,000 points, 11 or 12 armies.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Solid amount then.
Yeah. Lots. Bit of collection on the way. And
do you generally paint up your armies to a 2,000 point thing, or do you sort of go, oh, there's some models I like and then go off that? What's your idea behind getting into an army?
I think it has been, it's probably been a little bit competitively driven the last couple of years to pick up armies, but also a bit opportunistic. When I see a really, really good deal for a new army where you're getting a solid core of something, I don't know, 1,500 points or whatever, and it may not be the absolute most competitive, but if you've got a Facebook sale or an eBay sale, it 50% RRP on an army I'm just generally interested in. I can't resist the bargain. And that often is the core starting of an army, and then you play once, twice, and realize actually the reason the person's selling it is probably this is not the competitive part of the army. And then you end up putting all that to a side and buy all the rest of the competitive stuff instead. At full RRP. But so a lot of my 11 armies, probably at least half of them have started from an opportunistic buy of some sort. Another one or two have been bought fully painted at kind of pro-painted, like really high-quality standards. I have found that when I've bought a second-hand army that is painted at a shit standard, I just don't like using it. I don't like playing with it. So
yeah, fair enough. I've
been selling it or just putting it in the bin collected dust, basically. I've got a couple of quite high-end painted armies that I've picked up from a couple of local painters or whatever else when they've decided to move on and they've sold it for a good price. And then my own armies that I've started from scratch, painted fully myself and really own and enjoy that process. I definitely prefer playing with my own models that I've painted myself and hobbied myself and got my own conversions rather than others. And don't like painting with crappily painted models. Even for local games.
Yeah. So you don't tend to really sell your armies once they've had a use. You sort of hang on to them all?
Yeah, you tend to hang on to them all. I'm blessed with a very large man cave space to store them all. I'm starting to get to capacity, but I also have a core of almost everything I'd want, so just little bits and pieces to add from here.
Do you find your draw towards these bargain armies, is it something that you also like aesthetically, or is it purely just it was a bloody bargain and you bought it?
There has to be some other interest to it anyway. I'm either want to explore it as a play style or aesthetically like it or something else. I don't just buy it for the sake of buying it. It has to be something I'd want. I think I probably did buy one or two things as just on the bargain, but realise that's those are ones that I have sold and moved on.
Well, you've hit my keyword bingo there. You said play style. What would you say is your general play style for your armies you have, and then why do you think you play like that?
I've been in competitive gaming in AOS now for a couple of years, and I sort of have a bit of a philosophy or view that to be a master of the game, you have to be able to at least tilt into any of the possible play styles, aggro, defensive, shooting, combat, control, jank, soup. I probably like a bit more techie, combo-y kind of builds, a little bit of janky stuff in there, like with slightly weird allies or coalition type elements with a nice high synergy. I'm probably a little bit biased towards aggressive rather than defensive. I don't think defensive is a particularly competitively viable strategy in the game. Just the way that the game's balanced, it seems to favour aggressive more than defensive majority of the time. Not that big a fan of control. I think control is a legitimate play style and has a role in the game, though it's relatively rare, but it tends to be a pretty unfun experience for both players. Like denying your opponent an ability to use their own toys is frustrating for them, and it takes a certain individual to feel pride in causing pain on the other. I've definitely dabbled in every play style, but I think I ultimately come back to a little bit more of a techie combo buff stack style style play style. I like there to be a bit more complex interactions. I occasionally play like an Ogres or Gargants or Iron Jaws as my three destruction armies, but always end up finding that they're very simple. They're a bit too kind of, it's just movement and combat and not techie enough for me.
Okay. Without speaking about maybe your world's armies, what other armies have been taking your fancy that lean towards that over the recent months?
STD has got a lot of that, and it's had to evolve with changes there. I liked Korn at the end of last year. I'm not quite sure I'm sold on new Korn. It's not quite as doesn't seem to quite be as fun, but the Korn was not particularly competitive viable, but mega fun in putting a combo on Scarbrand to then just go absolutely crazy and wipe the opponent's army and like a big double triple attack combo all over the board. That's a lot of fun. You could only ever pull it off a couple of times per event because everyone knows just shoot Scarbrand. But when you pulled it off and you had that turn of just carnage, it's awesome. So it sort of goes to that techie kind of combo-y thing and the aggro. I haven't actually got there. One army I don't have, but I actually quite like, and if I saw a good one for sale on the cheap, I'd pick it up, is Sylvaneth. I like some of the strike and fade techie stuff there. It's got some weaknesses competitive, but it's quite a fun kind of army, I think. So, yeah.
Do you enjoy, maybe not outside play styles, but do you enjoy having like a low model count army or a higher model count army? What do you prefer on the tabletop?
Oh, probably mid, somewhere around the, I don't know, 50 models is good. A 300 model zombie army, no thank you.
Why not?
just randomly picking a particular style maybe that others like, not for me. Just too much fiddliness. And these super elite, I don't know, 20 model armies or 4 model gargants, play with them occasionally, but just not quite enough to do. Something around the 50 models is good. 60 models, 70, whatever, something in that order. A couple of blocks of something, a couple of screens, a couple of big monsters, something like that. To me, that feels like a balanced army, whatever that might actually mean. Yeah.
Very much so with like a Korn army or a Slaves of Darkness army and stuff like that.
Yeah, or a Cities of Sigmar army, Stormcast, or that. Yeah.
Like there's stuff you can spam in there which would be very horde like, or you could go the Varangard route and go very elite. But
yeah,
it's a very easy both armies to pick up more, bit of cavalry, bit of infantry with a big hitting monster and a few heroes. It's like the generic sort of 50, 60 model army.
Yeah, I do like the visual look of when you've got something that looks like a classic medieval army, like a block of Chaos Warriors with some heavy cavalry, some screaming light cavalry or war dogs or whatever, and then maybe a monster, which is obviously not historical, but it sort of feels like a potential sort of medieval real army kind of flavor to it.
And you said you've got quite a lot of armies. Do you generally flick through armies once every few months, or you stick with them for about a year and a half, 2 years? What's your army style like?
I've probably got a main that I'm playing, and usually it's the main that I'm running competitively for usually three or four events. And then I get a little bit bored with it and time to cycle over to something new. But to keep the main army fresh instead of just playing that constantly every week at the club night, every event and practice games, I mix in other stuff as I go. So randomly just pull out those ogres or iron jaws or whatever, just for the occasional game.
The easier armies to pick up, to show competence by throwing on the table, but they've got a lot more behind them if you spend the months and the years sort of taking them out properly, but they're easy enough just to throw on the table.
Exactly. Yeah, you can remember them and play them to, like, if it's just casual club game or whatever, you can play them well enough that it's not just going to get stomped just by picking them up and remembering their basic maneuvers, where something like a Seraphon or a Cities or a Zench or something, unless you've got that dialed in, you're probably going to get stomped.
Yeah, fair enough. And what generally forces you to cycle to a new army? And then what army are you then jumping onto? Is it something that is usable in the meta, or something that you think is going to be anti-meta? What's your ideas behind the new army?
I don't know. I'm probably there. I don't think I ever take any completely underpowered army. For some reason, I'm slightly loath to jump on the full whatever the current very short-term S-tier meta kind of army is. I think I'm generally playing something that's like competitive, but at that sort of second level, not the meta, whatever people consider the meta king kind of to be is. I'm sure some other people, maybe some of your listeners would argue that I've taken some meta armies at times, but generally I'm not aiming at that. I'm aiming at that one notch below. It feels like you're still winning, you're still competitive, you're still at the competitive end, but you're not just auto-winning in games. You have to still actually think about it. Sometimes the skew in the game balance, if you're playing against less experienced players, the absolute S tier hyper optimized, it's a boring game into more casual players that are playing funsies list. Where if you're taking the notch below, usually you're still going to win comfortably, but it's at least more interesting for both players.
Yeah, that's
actually
fair,
worth
yeah.
playing. There is a pathway to victory for the opponent. Mm-hmm.
So you like a game that's enjoyable for both sides. You don't want to try and push that utmost filth where it sort of feels like it's an oppressive army for your opponent to deal with.
Yeah, yeah. And I think that also reflects the Australian tournament scene. There is a set of players who are at the kind of hyper-competitive, uber-competitive type thing, and that's awesome. And I am in one of those kind of the groupings. But you're playing five games, you're spending 3 hours with your guy across the table, you're building a community, you're building friendships as you go, and you're at a tournament is a competitive environment, so you want to win, but you also want to make friends and do the social side along the way. And it's if you can win while making friends and building a social side and having an enjoyable play experience for both players, even if you're stomping the shit out of them with something, but at least you've given them a chance, or you can point out at the back end that there was a if you had done this and this, you could have actually counted my army.
Yeah, which I suppose is part of the tournament scene, being the 3 to 4 games at the start of a tournament generally aren't ultra competitive unless you come up against those players.
Yeah.
And if you bring that week list, sure, those games will be a lot closer, but that's not what people are looking for a tournament. So it's a bit hard to tailor towards those softer games and softer players that don't enjoy bringing that competitive list,
yeah,
which you can't help yourself because it's a tournament. You're there to be competitive.
Exactly, exactly. And people should expect it. Like, there are some people who go to a tournament with a casual and have fun mind, but people should expect that they're going to run into competitive lists and competitive players at a competitive event.
Yeah.
Oh, I got stomped by that competitive player running. It's a freaking tournament.
Yeah. What's your, like, tournament experiences like? Because I know from the few times we've caught up and stuff like that, a lot of the guys that we hang out with are quite heavy drinkers, or they enjoy drinking a lot while playing the tournament. What's your sort of tournament go-tos and stuff like that?
No, I'm probably not much of a drinker on the day during an event on alcohol. Unfortunately, I have a bad tendency to maybe drink a bit too much on the Saturday night. And so game four is often a rough game. And if I look at my track record, it's probably my most common game dropped. And you don't want to just blame the hangover, but there is a contribution to making silly mistakes when you're hangover, particularly if you're at a top of tables one. And that said, a lot of people are hungover or nightly off, so I'm not, I'm probably slightly undisciplined there.
I think that's most tournament games, because we're having so much fun at the night, because you're seeing all your friends and stuff. The environment just leads you to drink too much, I think.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And I think if I was super keen that I had to win an event or something, I'd probably, I was at the final event of the season and wanted Masters points or something, because I was not quite in the Masters, and I'd probably try and hold myself back from the alcohol, but generally, whatever.
Is Masters points generally something you play for at a tournament? And is Masters, do you generally make it to Masters most years?
Well, Masters have struggled the last few years due to COVID disruptions, but yes and no. So I like to lock in the Masters points where I can. I think you go into every event with, well, what am I going for? What type of list am I going for? What am I doing? Never taking completely soft, but sometimes taking a bit more experimental. And over the last few years, there's also been some experimental stuff put up for, like, leading into the World Championships. So just trying out different things that could have been relevant for the world's team structure, but less relevant in singles. But I don't know, generally I'm pretty happy with, like, a 4-1 style thing. Obviously you want to do well and whatever else, but I'm not going to kill myself trying to go for a 5-0, which is pretty hard. And getting a 5-0, unless you're Joel Graham with the way he plays, you need luck, matchups, list, everything. Everything needs to go right. There is no such thing as an easy pathway or 5-0. You just, on the day, you need everything to go right.
Yeah, that's fair.
You get the best list, the most perfect everything, and you have a shocker on the dice, and you're into a rock, paper, scissors hard matchup that you can't control, and you've lost your run. I think it is realistic that people can aim at 4-1, but yeah, aiming at 5-0 is...
There's very select few people who can aim for a 5-0.
Yeah.
They seem to... Even on those paper versus rock matchups, they'll still pull that win out of their ass, and everyone's just like, sure, okay, only you could do that.
But you have to admire them. There's a few you can do that, but yeah.
So you said your goal was 4-1 at most points. Do you generally find you reach that goal?
Yeah, most of the time I get comfortably to 4-1. It just is what it is. There's a lot of... pretty experienced hand at the game, and two or three games that are with way less experienced players, and even with good lists, I'll know what their list does more than they do, and I'll just be able to outplay them.
And talking about lists, are you much of, like, a list writer yourself? Do you net list, or do you have, like, a think tank, or you just go solo? What's your ideas behind list writing?
Definitely not net list. I don't even know where to find that. I like to think of my own stuff first and read the book first, but then often do consult with a couple of the more competitive players within Geelong Lost Legion Club to refine a germ of an idea. And in some other contexts, yeah, also sort of list lab with some of the more competitive players as well. And then in, a Team Australia context, you've got the whole Team Australia. You're designing lists for teams, which is different to singles, but it is a bit of a forum to discuss some competitive ideas as well. So, definitely read the book first and come up with. I very heavily try and read the book first myself without even watching like coaches review or the leaks or AOS Honest War Game or anyone else who does a book review early. I'll deliberately not watch them for their reaction and want to read the book every book first before I watch any YouTube reviews and come up with my own initial gut feelings on things and then start testing them and seeing a little bit what others might think.
And what's your sort of first ideas behind your lists when you get that new fresh book?
Probably got a kind of radar up for very powerful but jankier abilities. There could be a little bit of a higher tech ceiling or higher ceiling to master properly. That excites me. Stuff that has a lot of interesting movement shenanigans that you can do, whether it's like run and charge or 6-inch pile-ins or denying the opponent's pile-in or some stuff like that. Things with movement tech is very powerful. Do keep an eye out for threat range is how an army can deliver significant damage from the longest threat. If there was no it's not easy to just bottle into a single stat, but it's in the absence of any other consideration, if you look at two armies, whoever has the damage from the longer range, so like damage times range, is going to win. So control either the fight sequence via, like, you'll get your charges off because you've got longer range to threaten, and therefore you can control the activation of the combat order, which is a massive advantage. Or for shooting, well, if you can shoot theirs from further away, you deploy distance and shoot further. It's a pretty good starting point that whoever has the longest threat range has an advantage in the game.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, that makes sense. Out for that or stuff that can stop that as well.
Do you enjoy playing around in the space of those weird interactions where it sort of it needs an FAQ or it doesn't know the wording's not quite right from Games Workshop? Do you enjoy that space as well? Or is it something you sort of shy away from?
Nah, I shy away from that. I've seen them in the past and I see a lot of people jumping on stuff going, oh, this is what they really meant, and it's always fucking nerfed, always. You may get away with it for a little bit, maybe one rata cycle before it gets closed off. So I'm a huge fan, absolutely huge fan in the competitive scene, no fac, no play. And by fac, we mean a proper fac, not just a one line. look, G-Dub aren't perfect. They're humans. The rules writers make mistakes. I think, people shouldn't jump on crazy, silly rules exploits because they usually do get closed reasonably quick. A classic one that I remember is Stormcast. Every time they release a new Stormcast book, they forget to update the you cannot move after teleport. And it's and the translocation still has effectively you can move after teleport. And for like the last four books, it's been the same thing. And all the Stormcast players, oh yeah, they actually really mean that you can do it. I'm like, yeah, you can't. Just wait till the fact drops. And no, I'm not going to play you with that rule, assuming that GW actually really mean it this time. Nah, I've got it wrong four times. I've got it wrong again, and they will errata it and close the loophole. I've been surprised by an occasional one where I've got it wrong, where I thought Lachlan the Soul Seeker was your ability to move after teleport and then actually use it in your opponent's phase. I thought they would have that was a mistake. They would have errated, but they haven't, and that survived like three or four erratas now. So you have to concede that they actually do intend that one. I do admit I thought that the interactions between slaves and Khorne were probably an oversight, but they'd be in there for like a 4 or 5 month period. They weren't going to be closed straight away, given that the Khorne book was out there. So an oversight, which was the Khorne keywording into slaves, was incredibly powerful for a brief moment there. I don't mind playing with those kind of combinations and stuff, because often they do last 3 or 4 months, and that is as long as anything lasts in the game in terms of the meta. But I was wrong on that one. They did close that one off actually pretty quick. And so I have to give credit to G-Dub rule writers. They are getting faster and tighter on their games. They still make mistakes. They still make silly errors. They still misunderstand the power of some of the things that they do, but I have to pay credit that they do close the loopholes a little bit quicker.
Yeah. So you enjoy overall the oversights where things have clear interactions, but they don't quite work the way a normal game would work, or if they do, what be it the Khorne thing where it just seems a bit weird, but it's not a big massive.
Yeah, but it was still 100% clear, like the rules as written were not ambiguous. They were, and they needed to rewrite the rules to close it. Where stuff that people argue, oh, my interpretation is X and therefore whatever.
Where it's an and or an any, just because they missed a Y and it changes the whole interaction and people can argue either way. And it's not a clear rules interaction. Those are the things you want to try and stray away from.
All those things, my view is, if you're even going to vaguely use a interpretation, like English grammar, whatever, that could be legitimately rules as written interpreted in two ways, and there is some of this stuff out there, you've got to get a TO call pre-event on how they would rule it. And almost every TO always rules it on the conservative side.
Who would have guessed it against you?
So, like, if you're going to go to an event where attempting to exploit a ambiguity without the TO clearance of it, expect that in game one your opponent's going to kick up a stink. The TO will come over and go, "No, you can't do that."
But didn't Games Workshop say there was no ambiguity?
Yeah, well, hashtag watertight.
Yeah.
Sorry for that poor guy.
He was definitely throwing on the coals for that one.
Yeah. Under the bus.
So I wanted to speak about some of your tournament experiences. Have you got a favourite tournament over the past few years that you've been to that you sort of try and make it a seasonal tournament you go to every time it's available?
Well, look, COVID has disrupted a lot of things in terms of regularity, and it's always tough. But I don't know that I'd say any individual tournament. I like all the different tournaments the Bendigo boys put on in Measured Gaming. Obviously, all the local Geelong tournaments. I've been up to a couple of Southeast Queensland tournaments and would love to get up there a bit more. Albury, the Border War tournament, was probably my first tournament, and I can't go this year, unfortunately, but it's a great event. Unfortunately, CanCon, no, you can't not talk about CanCon. I think hopefully somebody's picking that up with Clint retiring and passing the baton on, but CanCon for sure. And I haven't managed to get to any Sydney tournaments, which is disappointing. Just I'd really like to get up there and meet some of the other Sydney guys. But yeah, absolutely love the Victorian and Southeast Queensland player communities, and I'm sure the Sydney guys who love the same hobby or same sort of will all be the same sort of blokes. So yeah.
I've definitely noticed, even in our gaming scene, a lot of it's the same thing with the Sydney. For some reason, Sydney just gets missed off the radar from a few gaming communities for whatever reason, and we all go down to Bendigo or Victoria, and you guys come up to Queensland more than any of us go to Sydney.
Yeah,
for whatever reason.
Not quite sure why. It's like flights to Sydney are really cheap, but accommodation and local transport is really expensive and difficult. Just not sure. It's sort of got a, I don't know. No, I can't quite pick out why it hasn't quite worked.
They've got awesome tournaments as well, like the Sydney GT and Sydney Slaughter. Yeah. Like they're all great hosts and tournament organizers.
Premium
and stuff like
events
that.
With everything like Schmickaz and.
It's just weird when you said that you've not been to them, and like no one in my gaming group's been to them for whatever reason. I don't understand why.
Hopefully we can all cross more paths as we go. I do think Sydney, last two or three years, Sydney got a pretty tough run with COVID. Sydney GT got deferred, cancelled, deferred. That makes it hard. And, yeah, just the timing of the COVID disruptions seemed to buy. Even though Melbourne had worse COVID disruptions and lockdown, the windows where it was open kind of coincided with our event cycle, where poor Sydney kind of had a rough run.
Yeah, they were very rough down there. Just
nothing for a while. But they now have, I was reviewing the league ladders and stuff. New South Wales had more events than anyone else. Obviously, Coach is a very high-profile social media figure for the community, even globally, and he's helped build up their event scene a lot, and a lot of other independent TOs as well. So, yeah, Sydney's going from strength to strength.
Yeah, it's good to see Sydney's recovering, I think, the most there. It seems like a lot of tournaments and great tournaments are going on down there.
Yeah, yeah. So hopefully I'll get up this year. I did manage to get a ticket to Sydney GT this year. So
oh, nice.
Coach's servers did melt down, which seems to be another trend with major events in AOS. CanCon melted down a few years ago, and I think Root had a meltdown. So I think it's... I was commiserating. Coach was pretty stressed, I think, about it all, but I did commiserate with him that, look, take it as the highest honour possible that, your event is in such demand that that you've got 100 people trying to click on and melting down your server. It's a possible honour for a TO.
Yeah, all the recent tournaments seem to be selling out within like 10 minutes, 5 minutes,
yeah,
or crushing the site, which is always good to see.
Yeah, and that's awesome. That shows that there's just this strong underlying demand for events and within the community, which is amazing.
Does Lost Legion run any events, or do you run any events yourself?
Yeah, well, Lost Legion as a club does a couple of sort of one-dayers a year. We're aiming to have two days. We'll probably only ever have one dayer in Geelong one 2-dayer in Geelong of kind of the 50-person size. So I think we'd like to get like a teams event or something going, but the Measurative in Bendigo have just announced a teams event. So that's hopefully we can build that up to be the kind of Runax of the South. Because teams play is amazing. The singles tournament is great, but teams is just another experience that's awesomeness too. But yeah, I think Lost Legion's probably going to have two events this year. One coming up, about to go on ticket sales pretty soon, I think.
What's the rest of Lost Legion like? Are they all pretty competitive? Part casual, part competitive? What's your team there like?
Yeah, it's really built up in the last six, 12 months or so. There was a sort of there was a big group for a while that had three or four competitive players and a bunch more people that were a little bit more casual and whatever else. And so that was a bit of a sort of two types within the club. For whatever reason, with various addition changes and other opportunities, a lot of those more casual guys fell off and did other hobbies or did other things. They're still kind of in the community and occasionally pop up for a game, but not quite as committed. And Lost Legion's, I think, very much become a competitive club. We've had a bunch of other players come in. There's still a few casuals, but everyone's sort of a bit more competitive in nature. I think we had 10 or 12 people at the last Bendigo event wearing the club colours and club shirts, which is great to see. And, yeah, it's a really good community vibe in there. We play every week on Tuesday nights at Guff as a shout-out. So Guff online store if anyone needs hobbies at a good price. And then is our local host. And then, often there's a weekend game somewhere. Sometimes I'm hosting it, sometimes in other places as well. So, yeah, pretty active.
How long have you been with Lost Legion for?
Well, pretty much since we started it. I think it was the second week. It didn't even have a name for a couple of years. And but Geelong's had an active player group with a weekly club night on Tuesday nights for probably 5 years, maybe 6 years now. And that's ranged from about 4 to 15 players rock up, four and it's kind of at its low, but the typical week has 10, 12 players each week.
Oh, solid. Because Guff's quite is it more tabletop focused or is it like Magic focused? What's their main thing there?
A bit of both. They've got tabletop gaming down one end of the hall and card gaming down the other end, and then
okay.
A bit in the middle. So, bit of both.
It's a pretty inclusive sort of shop then to play out.
Yeah. And Guff are a local franchise also. They're in Bendigo and they're the sort of main independent franchise in Bendigo as well. So they support the AOS community up there as well, which is great. So,
yeah, I did see them at CanCon. So it's good to see a bit of representation for the stores because I know they do a lot of work with the Bendigo guys, which is always nice to see.
Yeah. They always support everything and they provide a great space. So, yeah, big shout out to the Guff.
One of the main reasons I've got Michael on here is Michael is quite involved with the Worlds team. He's also involved with, like, the Masters season. So he's quite versed in all those spaces. Do you just want to give a little spiel of how you got involved with all of it and what sort of roles you have entailed for yourself?
Yeah, so when I first started going to events, it was just going to the event. I didn't have any comprehension that there was a sort of wider linkage. But then somebody mentioned the Masters. I'm like, oh, well, what's that? And it's something that and then found the ladders where everyone's event is tracked that Clint was running for many years since 2016. And it was like, oh, this is pretty cool. You see your results. You could track what everyone's doing. You like the competitive ladder and a bit of a sort of league feel, and it's got all the events in it. And so I sort of discovered it via that, and then started playing more events and becoming competitively successful. So I saw myself rising up through the ladders in both the faction ladders and that I was playing and the overall ladder. And it comes a bit of pride when you see yourself rising up. Like, there's a little bit of ego and pride seeing that, okay, I'm top three player in Australia. Cool. That's really cool to sort of have in the public ladders and whatnot. So Clint was running it all in those days, and then Clint put together a sort of wider committee with a state rep for everyone, for each of the states, to sort of help coordinate things a bit. The state rep role for Victoria cycled through Bendigo. The Bendigo club captain, John McGrath, was on it, and then he stepped down for a bit. And then Will Knight, who's one of the Melbourne major clubs, their captain, president, I don't know, whatever, he stepped down. And then, I think Will proposed, oh, well, why not Clarkie? As And it was a little bit of a case of the three centres of AOS in Victoria are Bendigo, Melbourne, Geelong. And as the sort of three big clubs and where the events and whatever have. So it was sort of almost like, well, Bendigo's had to turn on the Masters Committee, Melbourne's had to turn on the Masters Committee, maybe it's Geelong's turn, and I got nominated. And I'm like, yeah, okay, I'll do that. And so, yeah, that's how I got involved with it all. Very much it's a distributed autonomous organisation. It's
out come the fancy words.
If any crypto bros there. The Masters League or the Australian League, there's no formal constitution. It's just an unofficial, semi-official, it's sort of hard to explain. It's just part of the community. It's a community service where somebody has to do something to coordinate. Like the ladders and putting together a finals event and creating a bit of hype to get that more Australia-wide community of people who care about something a bit more longer term hyping up the competitive scene to then create more events and more hype is just really a community service to do it. And I think I think it does create a bit of a community and almost everybody who's a multi-tournament goer, no one cares about Master, but everyone knows exactly where they're sitting within their faction ladder. So,
At least we're not as bad as the ITC, from what I hear.
Yeah. Look, there's no formal governance per se. It's more, I think, each of the reps is generally respected and recognised within their status. As a go-to person to provide a bit of guidance on how to run an event, how to put something together, what could matter. And then try and make some contentious decisions to actually put like the final series Masters themselves together. So the all the results from the regular season, from all the different events run by the independent TOs get aggregated up, and then the top players, based on the scoring methodology, then get invited to a invite-only Masters event, which is, occurring in Brisbane this year in 2 or 3 weeks, 22nd of April. And that's kind of the best of the best. And I think in general, the winner of Masters has been widely recognised by the tournament community as the Australian champion, as the best. They've proven themselves as by going through that trial by fire, and they could take pride in that and celebrating their success and from their peers and from the community, and recognising that they're obviously been a great player to get there.
Yeah, correct. And you do a lot of the write-ups. So I remember seeing your name as like the tag on a lot of the write-ups. Are you still doing that these days?
Yeah. But I've taken a fair bit of that on this year in the back end, and then post and cross-post on that stuff.
As someone that reads them whenever they pop up, you're doing a wonderful job. Like, there's lots of like handy information there. It's nice to see it all like displayed nicely, and like it's just, it's well set out and well thought out. So I'm sure a lot of people that do read through it do appreciate the effort you put in terms of all that sort of writing and that. Because I know it's not an easy sort of, it's not a 5-minute job. You put a decent chunk of time in there to get them looking all nice and presented properly.
Definitely. And if it gets one more player into coming to multiple events and it grows one more event, then it's a win because expanding the community. There's not much of a formal structure per se around it, but the underlying mission of the Masters League is to celebrate competitive success, and I think that's a good mission statement to make it a lot more corporate and official than it is. That it's good someone's doing that. It's not a money-making exercise. It's a loss-making and time-sink and volunteer service, that's for sure. But, if it builds a community, builds a bit of bonds of friendly competitive rivalry across the community and across all of Australia and creates a bit of linkage, then that's a win.
And Clarkie's lovingly sent through some diagrams and a post, which I'll put on like involved with the Twitter when I post that up. And I'll also put it for people that don't follow on Twitter in the description. I'll post some links so you can follow along as we talk later along, because I'm sure it's going to get a bit confusing. There's a lot of, it's a lot of flowing to these flow charts.
Yeah.
But there is some beautiful explanations written in English, which is nice. It's not just two guys speaking about it. It's well written out. So if you don't follow along very well with voices, it's written there nice and easily displayable. And there's a few lovely photos of Team Australia and some sort of other things as well in there. So be sure to click out those links.
Yeah, I think there, and encourage you encourage people to go to the links over at Sigma Central with a kind of description of what's going on. I think really it's the pathway of competitive success in Australia, and this is not defined by me. I think this is just me reflecting how it works, because it's been a lot of informal kind of stuff. Look, anyone who wins a tournament gets the congratulations. They get the trophy. It's in the trophy cabinet, and inevitably their local community and the TO will hype up that they were the winner. It's part of the kind of event thing, and that's an awesome feeling as well. The sort of next layer up is the Masters, which reflects somebody who has consistent success beyond just one event, and they've had to win multiple events or be podium or whatever, multiple events just to even get to the Masters. And then obviously whoever wins the Masters is winning a best of the best invitational and creating a bit of proof point that they are the best player in Australia. And that's kind of within what we have today in Australia, that's the peak of competitive success in Australia, winning multiple events, getting to Masters based on having won multiple events and consistent display of competitive success, and then winning the Masters itself. But there is another layer above that, which is the World Championships and the World Team Championships, which is a long-running event that came out, and you mentioned ITC before. It actually was part of the ITC and ETC and then whatever, but it has a 20-year history going back into Warhammer days, and Australia has sent teams back in the old Warhammer Fantasy Battle days, and well before my time, I wasn't involved in them, though current captain was. Then ultimately, really, you're then going to a World Championships, where last year there was 25 teams from 25 different countries, and you're playing usually the best of the best within those countries, the best of the best within England, the people that were in the equivalent of their Masters, the best of the best within France and Denmark and everywhere else. And ultimately, that's the absolute peak of thing. If Team England won it last year, but they basically took everyone and they were the best team, and they beat everyone else. And that's the real peak, the absolute peak, to go represent your country at Warhammer in your chosen sport. If you're really committed to this hobby and sport, you get picked to represent your country, wear some green and gold, wear a jersey. That's a pretty special feeling. And then, being part of a team as well to go and play the very best players in the world is pretty awesome.
It's definitely a sport at that end, because you're having to do team practice. You're having to do like sort of speak on like your values. There's a lot more involved than just you playing your mates or doing a bit of online play and then going to a tournament and winning it all. And you could nearly say the same thing about the Masters. You could pretty much go in solo if you just got a good enough brain and a good enough experience. But the World's team is a whole different ball game completely.
Definitely, and that's I'm just looking. I had one of my Team Australia shirts here, but I think my wife must have taken it out for the washing or something. I could have waved it around, but I don't know. If anyone who is interested in competitive play and making the stake, it's I think you should be aiming at Masters, of course, locally. But have a think about. Can you afford it? Do you want to? Do you want to go the commitment to go all the way to the World Championships and commit yourself to this sport for a competitive run at that? You do need to. It is a serious endeavor. There's obviously a lot of cost to go to Europe to play Warhammer.
For us as a country, it's a massive expenditure of time and money.
It is. And that's an extra degree of difficulty for Australia, but it is what it is. And that actually helps weed out only the most committed will go into it as well. But it's, I don't know, it is a real honour to get picked for the team. And if this is your chosen sport or chosen hobby, then wearing your country's colours is pretty special.
And how did you?
No, you... Sam, you're New Zealander by native. New Zealand has an even bigger trouble putting a team together. So it's kind of there's mechanisms in a constitution and whatever else, but we've sort of reserved a slot for a New Zealander or two to join the team and under Anzac spirit because let's be realistic. New Zealand's not going to be able to find eight players to go all the way to Europe.
No, at the moment, the way the game is, it's going to be definitely hard for us to try and get that amount of people because it costs even more.
If we could bring you in as pretend Aussies.
Yeah. Well, considering we had to get two mercenaries last year, it sort of makes sense as well to be able to open it up to a slightly wider audience because there's obviously some strong players in New Zealand.
Yeah, definitely.
That have taken out a lot of Australian tournaments. So that always adds to that little bit there.
For sure. And this year we have Jimmy Page, who was winner of CanCon a couple of years ago. And he's won a New Zealand Masters a couple of times. So real asset to the team.
Yeah. So how did you get involved with being selected last time for Worlds? And then what's your involvement this year?
Yeah, so initially I got selected I think Nick was running at who was a Melbourne TO at the time. He's not heavily involved in the scene at the moment, but I don't know, just put a random application in. I'd had a couple of good competitive games and a couple of good competitive events, but I was still at the relatively early stage of my kind of competitive career. And I was starting to rise through the ranks and I'd done pretty well at a few events. But I don't know, I just randomly put the application in, didn't really expect to get anything. I was actually probably more thinking, maybe I'll get it on the next run, but if I put my express interest in this run, I haven't quite got a good enough track record to fully deserve to be on the team at that point in time. But by expressing interest, the selectors will kind of know and I'll if I get the success rate over the next year, I'd make a good case to get on it the next year if I have expressed interest in this year. So I was probably more thinking that. But at the time, a variety of things, and I think I snuck in as kind of the lowest ranked player to get on the team at the time. And I justified the selectors. I believe I ratified the selectors' decision to back me into that with subsequent very good run of competitive success. The getting to Worlds was challenging because the original Worlds was right when after quite a long period I got disrupted with COVID heavily and delayed us getting there, so the team was spent a long time together and went through a few iterations and a few people having to drop away because obviously extended time. So I think of the very original team that got put together, it was only Matt Terrell and myself that ended up still as.
Oh, wow. Okay. I knew a few people dropped
through. So.
Yeah. But I didn't realize so many people because I know it was like nearly 3 or 4 years of false start. So it was a lot of
years because of the COVID disruption. That was pretty bad. It was a pretty extended period through there where obviously Matt was team captain and he won the most recent Masters pre-COVID and I stayed on the team and had a competitive, pretty good competitive record through that time. Then We went last year. We did okay. We were aiming higher. We did get to top tables for the final round against England, and then they smashed us so hard that that punted us down to, I think we got 10th in the end. So it was pretty awesome getting to top tables in the final round. But then just the nature of the scoring mechanism there, by then being so high up and then just getting smashed so badly in the round, it dropped us a lot. So, maybe a better strategy would have been to lower and try to pump in, though, which was the Sweden strategy. They deliberately targeted to then pump up an easier game in round five instead of having to play England, who was just so strong.
You can never win off a submarine, though. Let's put it that way. No, at least you guys... win off
a submarine.
We all know the pain of playing in the final and being kicked out, and then you're down so low that you don't get the podium. But at least you can say, like, you're in the final and you're vying to win the whole thing. Like, I think ultimately, as a scene that was watching, that's probably, although you didn't get the great result, like being able to say, oh, I was in the final, is probably more of a prouder moment than saying, oh, I got second because I lost my first.
Yeah.
Not following Sweden, but in general, losing your first one and then pipping second or third is not as good as playing in the final.
No one ever remembers who comes second or third.
Yeah.
Look, England was so dominant and so far ahead on points, the way the point system was there. Even if we had won the last game, I think they would have still been top. We would have been silver, but it's that they were that far ahead because the way the point system worked in that. But, geez, it would have been nice. If we had to beat them, that would have been gold, but it would have been like, yeah, but you lost to the silver.
Yeah.
Had a bit of a moral victory. Alas, that story was not to be because they absolutely thumped us. So.
And here we were thinking that the Ashes was just a little play by you guys to not show that you were sharks.
Nah. We got towed.
Yeah. I heard you did a bit of a struggle with your list, though, with a few last-minute adjustments.
Yeah, a bit of problems. So the process, and I can see where we've got some of the same challenges this year without going too far into the depths of the list labbing for this year. But last year there were some rapid meta changes at the end. Anybody who is a BOC player would know they went from crap tier to god tier. completely unexpected. No one saw it coming. It wasn't on like a known battle tone coming or anything else. It was just an adjustment, and boom. That was a major meta shift that we were called flat-footed on. No one had a BOC army. We didn't have, like, just completely last minute. I think the army selection process, we pretty much, the top four armies were pretty consistent across almost every team. They had the same Stormcast, Nurgle, Seraphon, kind of as the top meta at the time. And we had those as well. But we were really struggling down in kind of army. There's eight players on Team Australia and eight players in the team event. Down at Army 7 and 8, there was a lot of armies that are arguably between number 7 and number 15 in the strength of the meta. And there was a lot of kind of attempts to go, well, what should we be taking? A lot of last-minute pivots and whatever else. One of the last-minute pivots was that I was on was an Archaon Slaves list with Idolaters. Very, very good list into melee meta, absolutely terrible into shooting, and very good into a couple of missions, like hero controlling the center objective. Plonk Archaon, invincible at the time with his reroll ones to save. Good luck shifting him. Nothing could kill him. almost nothing. So very good into some missions and very good into certain matchups with the way that army was geared. But then we ran into a unannounced problem where they announced that after list submission that we're going to be using impassable terrain. this was not a happy moment for myself or the team. I was frankly livid. Going all the way over to Europe and the expense of that, and taking an almost effectively an unusable model where if you're playing with Impassable. I also have a nice, deep, long essay on Impassable Terrain over at Sigma Z.
I wonder why.
No salt at all about that. But it genuinely was a major meta-shifting thing to announce after people had submitted the list. And the terrain rules in AOS, you have to be at least 6 inches apart, but Archaon's base is 6.4 inch. So two pieces of Impassable, he can't fit. So the large Archaon, Alerial, a few others, but Archaon's what we were taking, basically become extremely difficult to use with that terrain rule set that was announced after list submissions. That caused a few problems. Not happy. So no Archaon this year, that's for sure.
Yeah. And obviously you can't speak on a lot of matters with Worlds at the moment. How is Worlds going for the Australian team at the moment? Because I believe you're on the team again this year.
Yeah, on the team again this year. We've learned a lot of lessons from last year. Experience does actually matter, particularly in a the team structure. So I think without going too deep into secret tech or whatever, but it was, I think, one of our lessons last year. We did a lot of analysis on matchups, like how does Iron Jaws go against Archaon, how does whatever, that we didn't put enough effort into thinking about the mission element, because within the Worlds, so a typical singles event, you've got five rounds, five missions. You could face anybody, of course, but you almost every event, at least in Australia, the TOs usually announce the missions beforehand. So you can sort of plan a little bit around that. You know what you're going to be playing. Within Worlds, the captains sit down at the start of the game, and there's basically a card game where they play missions and matchups, trying to get the best best matchups and pairings for the team and avoid the worst. We put quite a bit of research and effort into the matchup component, but not enough into the mission component. And so, that was one lesson from last year to improve on this year.
Yeah, and you can see the contrast, because I believe from listening to Miscast and a few other English podcasts, their theory was the opposite, which was all their time was spent into matchmaking, into the missions rather than the opponent's army. And you can see the score difference with England. They pretty much nearly capped out the score on every round, and that's how they were planning. So
they got it right, and I think most people, I think a lot of the other teams were same into analysis of of matchup as opposed to the mission. I think, from what I understand on the public disclosures of England or whatever, and who knows how they really work behind scenes, but they had like their top four, kind of the most powerful meta armies, were geared at just winning the game because they were the meta army, so they should win. And then their other four were geared deliberately at the missions each round to win. So that's, at least that's how we understand it.
It's Team England. They got a lot of secret and a lot of spreadsheets.
Exactly.
And how are you guys finding this year? Because I know there's been a lot of battle tomes released. There's the GHB that's cycled every 6 months. How is Team Australia finding it this year?
Well, we went in hoping that we could lock the armies and lists a lot earlier. And GW, really, the last couple of battle tomes are meta-defining. And it was, even pre-Christmas, it was really not sure. Will KO come out in time? Horn and Slaanesh, like, there was a lot of uncertainty what the GW roadmap was at Christmas. There was a sort of view that probably Korn and Slaanesh would drop, but KO would be right on the border, but KO ended up coming a bit earlier. Gits was known to be coming, but probably not known to be quite as powerful as it actually is. That book is pretty busted.
No, stop saying that. There's other books that are newer and they're more busted.
I think, yeah, the since Christmas, when ideally we wanted to lock in early, one, you needed to see the JHB, which was actually pretty defining. Like the GC meta is like pretty defining. If you're not listing and thinking about that, then it matters. So there was a bit of had to wait and see what the JHB will be around missions and stuff like Galatian Champions before you can really lock armies in. And then even from the initial days, okay, well, the Galatian Champion meta, this thing will look like this. And then the last four battle tomes or four of the last five battle tomes have been pretty powerful, like Gits, KO, Slaanesh, and Bok are all very powerful tomes. I'm not quite sure about maybe. and they define the meta. So some of the stuff that pre-Christmas was thought of as maybe pretty good has had to be cycled out. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. When is list lock, out of curiosity?
List lock, I think, is mid-April somewhere. We have to submit lists, maybe 20th of April, something like
there's
that.
There's no more expected battle tomes to drop in that time.
No more expected battle tomes. The big thing, the rules at Worlds are supposed to lock end of this week, I think, which is deliberately, the Australian Masters has aligned the same date. For rules, because there's a lot of players at Masters who are on the world's team. It's Masters then is playing with the same rule set as Worlds in an ideal world. So everyone is sweating on, is the Battle Scroll going to come out this week? Is Slaanesh KO and Korn, Fax and Arata going to come out this week? The speculation is what the hell happens if, like everyone said, I think it's like the 9th of April or something is the list lock or is the declared lock. What the hell happens if GW release it on the 10th, which is probably what Probably everyone's going to go, well, we should use that.
Yeah, which is always hard because we are obviously nearly a day ahead of the UK.
Yeah. So I'm already anticipating there's going to be some degree of controversy about both Worlds and Masters because GW... They'll manage to release the Battle Scroll and the facts just at a point in time that is just creates a bit of ambiguity and what should we all do?
and then also the Worlds players are also having like scrims and such after the Masters season.
Yeah.
And so you've got that as well.
Yeah. Who knows? It'll be a decision by the committee, but hopefully GW just release it this Wednesday or something and it's just no issue. But if there is some... scenario where it comes out one day after cutoff, what do we do? We probably need to consult players and work out what we do. But everyone wants to play with as fuller, close to the current meta as possible. You don't, yeah.
And at least the easiest part is you've got very few amount of people you've got to convince, and they're all people there at the tippity top of the season anyway, so they're quite competitive players that generally have the thumb on the pulse.
But yeah, so they're generally and nearly everyone has access to multiple armies to be able to pivot and do whatever. And
yeah.
There is also, so for a different event where maybe there's people who've collected their entire army and they've had a 3 or 4 month run where they've done nothing but collect this army and then a week before list submission, you get a rules change that completely wrecks everyone. That's a little bit rougher and harder for TO to make a call versus a pure competitive event where people can probably pivot and understand the pivot and change a bit easier.
Is there any other dilemmas that are happening around anything that most people wouldn't be aware of but maybe is happening with the Worlds or the Masters that you could speak on?
Probably nothing I'd be at liberty or wanting to speak on
tonight. Yep, fair enough.
Yeah.
Because I know sometimes it's like, oh, I didn't really think of that occasion, especially like with the FAC and the Errata happening. Most people wouldn't even have that in their brain that those two things are happening at the same time on deliberate. So to have this big issue sitting in the background that unless you're involved with either the Worlds or Masters, you're just not aware of it whatsoever.
Yeah, and this is part of that whole commitment to it as a sort of amateur sport. You need to stay right on top of what's going on.
So are you coming up for the scrim? And then did you also make it into the Masters season for the tournament as well?
I made it to Masters this year. I have a slightly conflicted role, as does Alexander Cronin, that we're both the state reps, but we actually made the event as well. So Masters has set up information barriers and whatever to preserve probity there. So Gabe and Coach and Dave and Mitch dealing with any rules queries or whatever, and the list submission goes to them. We don't see it. It goes straight to Gabe's personal email address. I never trust Gabe, so that's all right.
So you're very excited to be involved with the Masters season this year then?
Yeah, definitely. It's going to be an absolute great event. We've got Gabe will be TO on the day, as obviously TO of Runax has some of the best terrain in the game. And Mick and Gemma, I think, are bringing some of their best terrain down and a streaming kit, which is awesome. So a bunch of other high-profile locals around Queensland will be hanging around. Hopefully yourself too, Sam, come in and say...
I will definitely be coming up and saying hello, that's for sure.
I think Gabe will be anointing some assistant TOs to keep an eye on the players. Well, so get your sheriff badge out. And, I'll probably need a bit of a shout-out to Irresistible Force, who's provided the gaming room for us. It's an excellent space and they're an excellent shop. So, yeah, Irresistible Force, get on it.
Yes, for sure. They've done well. They've expanded in size as well over the past few years to accommodate a lot of event space.
Yeah. It's a absolute perfect event space for an event of this size in that gaming room they have.
It is, yeah.
Not too big, not too small, everything you need.
Barring any facts or riders coming out, have you locked in your own list?
No idea, because it's probably dependent on the fact. very difficult, because I have been running slaves for quite a while, but the meta has hurt slaves badly with some of the new stuff that's come out.
Do you find it a bit of a struggle because you're in think tanks with a lot of players that are also going to Masters to then talk about your own list, or you pretty much talk it very openly with everyone and everyone's got the same sort of vibe going in?
I don't know. I don't think there's too much being held back within Team Australia, but there's a bit, I think. I think there's a little bit being held back. I certainly am not talking about my Masters list. I think and I hope everyone on Team Australia is probably putting Team Australia and the Worlds as the highest, and then Masters as a secondary kind of glory. But I think there might be a little bit of holding back. But something that is a bit different is that team structure, and writing lists for teams is definitely different than writing lists for singles. Teams where either each player on the team's either focused on certain matchups or missions and is skewing the list around that, and the team, the overall team composition, so of the eight armies, how many melee armies, how many tanky armies, how many shooting armies, how many one drops versus many drop, whatever, it's a different equation than for singles. For singles, you often building a list to both the top meta and the missions that are in an individual playback. So you've probably got five missions you have to consider. In world, you're probably considering less missions that you have to gear into, while having a little bit of an idea, what if I don't get those missions? So you've got maybe another three missions that could be your backup, and a couple of missions that you're a complete no-go on. And then it's the same with matchups. There's some matchups that you like. Okay, in a singles list, you have to take certain things to be able to be okay. I might run into that matchup, and if I do, I'd get smashed. So you need to take something to counter that. Where in teams, you can go, okay, I don't have any anti-horde tech, for example. So if the French team runs up with 320 zombies, which they probably will, don't put my list into that because it can't work. It will lose. It doesn't deal with the hordes. Where in singles, you probably have to have some kind of tech to deal with a horde or whatever. So it's definitely different on what you take as your list build. With those different constraints and what you're aiming at.
Do you struggle trying to separate the two, or you think they blend together pretty easily?
No, it is a little bit of a struggle to keep the different ideas in your head. But I do think that kind of, amateur sport, treating it as an amateur sport, you're putting a fair bit of effort and investment and time and brain cycles in thinking. And I do think, at competitive Warhammer, you need to know what most armies do, what their tricks are, what everything is. I suspect most of the top end competitive players in Australia have two or three armies fully dialed in that they could pick up and play competitive basically on the spot. And most could probably pick up almost anything and at least be half decent at it. They wouldn't have it fully dialed in, but at least know what its core tricks and ideas are. So keeping all that in your head anyway is, well, that's part of the commitment that if you're going down this path to something like Worlds, that you have to commit to that research and knowledge. And it's just yet another element that goes into that. And with GW evolving the meta so fast, you have to constantly be researching and watching the new battle tomes and figuring out what they might do.
As someone that's probably flown around with the biggest model around, do you find a Team Australia or certain people have the consideration for taking armies that are flight safe as well as being competitive?
Yeah, it's a little bit, but I don't think that's considered a constraint. People will take whatever the competitive is to do it, and people will figure out logistics. So, yeah. Amazingly, I took Archaon with Splintered Fang, and so mega-sized monster model, and Splintered Fang have a lot of whips and chains and nets, other kind of spindly bits. And the only, all the way to Europe and back, and the only model that I broke was a single Brimstone Horror that snapped off its base. And that was just summoning reserve. So, yeah.
That's pretty solid.
Very amazing that it. So these armies travel a lot better. Warhammer armies travel a lot better than we fear they do.
As someone that successfully traveled with that sort of stuff, did you have any tips for people wanting to fly with their armies then?
Yeah, so I packed in luggage, which was a major, major risk. So you
checked it in as well?
Yeah, checked in luggage.
Well, okay.
My checked in luggage, I do have my own special box for Archaon with a foam inserts and everything all just like perfectly for him. And then a second box where everything else was in there with heaps of foam and whatever. The key is just like sending a package in the mail. You just don't allow movement. Have it packed in tight enough, and then with all my clothes and other stuff, the suitcase was full. So even if bloody baggage handlers threw stuff around, if there's nowhere to move, things can't break. The biggest risk, which I know Stu is only just solving now from his Gankon army, a big danger is, will they actually lose the freaking luggage if you check it in?
Oh, no.
So, baggage handlers have been known for that as a problem recently, or airlines. Last year I took the gamble because Archaon's too big to actually take on carry-on with the rest of the army. But I think most of the guys last year had some sort of magnetized case for carry-on.
Well, I threw up on Twitter as well. Seems we're ending it up here. I did have one little tease I wanted to put out there. I've been speaking to a few other people around the Masters season. And so I'm going to try and organize two more podcasts to coincide with the running of the Australian Masters. I'm trying to, if this will all be deleted if it doesn't work out, we're going to try and organize another podcast with Michael and Gabe. Awesome. And we're going to speak about some of the info and also tidbits and stats and stuff like that of what's happening with people that are involved with the Masters season. So be on the lookout for that. And then I'm also trying to set up with Corey. Once lists are submitted, he's going to run over. Pardon?
List review show.
Yeah, so he's going to run over, not necessarily a list review show, but maybe go over the strengths of the players because he knows quite a lot of the people, maybe the strengths of the lists and how they operate rather than just run straight down through the lists, because I don't think people find that entertaining anyway. But more the strategy and the strengths behind the lists. So be on the lookout for that over the next few weeks.
Yeah. And I think I would add one other thing in that I'm sure Corey will capture. The Masters player pack has a bit of a unique model to it in that it's a seeded model where the first two rounds are a known matchup. So that, gives an extra flavor to the meta of trying to predict what your known opponent, or it will soon be known who the opponents are, what your known opponent's going to take, what's their favorite army, and do you take an army that can go all the way, or do you take an army to make sure that you can get through round one? Or
And for those that aren't aware, seeded means the top-ranked player who has generally done the strongest over the whole season will be playing the bottom-ranked player who is made it in by the skin of their teeth, more generally prioritizing that the top end of the tournament will most likely play each other at the end of the tournament rather than knock each other out very early on.
Definitely. The goal is if number one and two in the regular season both win all their games, they should be fighting on the top table final round for the gold. Which is their right for having done so well in the season.
Correct, yep. And then if you've followed other gaming systems, it seems that when people know what they're coming up against, they spend all the mental energy of coming up with a counter, and then that person brings something completely different and it all goes to waste.
Yeah.
So from other gaming systems, the top tip is just manage and plan your own list and don't care about what you're coming up against.
Yeah, probably. It's just too hard.
Like, yeah, there's too many variables. There's too much going on for you to try and sit down and sort out what your opponent is maybe bringing, because if you bring that counter and they bring something else, that may as well just make your list unusable.
Yeah, exactly. And you still have to win four games to lay a claim to the Masters title. So, yeah, just playing to win one game that first game is probably not a good strategy.
No, that is very true. So I've got a few questions here for Clarky. For those that also aren't aware, we have a very famous cricketer here called Michael Clark, as well as the AOS player Michael Clark, for people that are outside Australia or don't follow the cricket. So a few of these questions lead into the naming similarity. First one is, Joel didn't ask any questions because I don't know what's going on with Joel. we've got Orkman up next. He'd like to understand why you're so obsessed with the Arcane Tome.
Yeah, well, that's a story for him. Orkman was one of our Hungarian friends who was a mercenary last year. And, within Slaves last year, I wanted the tome, and I made my case, and I genuinely believe it was a strong case, but got allocated to the Iron Jaws list instead.
Orkman had that Iron Jaws list.
So, the tome is a highly contested asset. So within the team structure for Worlds, you're only allowed one of each artifact, and Tome and Master of Magic are generally two commonly seen items across the meta where they have a lot of benefit into a lot of different armies. So it's a bit contentious about who gets to take the Arcane Tome because it's such a strong item, and who gets to take Master of Magic as for best benefit.
Especially when there's eight people, so eight armies are fighting over it, and a lot of them have viable choices for taking that Arcane Tome.
Yeah, Tome, Master of Magic, and a couple of the more powerful Endless Spells are the most kind of contentious items.
The joy of generic things. We've got two more basic questions here. What was going through your mind when you scored your first test ton ever on spinning a subcontinental pitch? And do you have a personal favorite innings over your career?
I think the best ton I ever took was when I managed to wind Scarbrand up at Runax and do 100 mortal wounds in a turn with these. Hero phase attack and then a double attack in combat and full buffage. So a ton of mortal wounds off Scarbrand, I think is theoretically possible. And I reckon I've broken that once or twice.
Oh, very nice. Very nice. Yeah. And going off of that, Gammy's also asked, are you enjoying your peroxide blonde hair?
Well, I did do that at university as a life mistake as an experiment, and does not work on me.
And then what about some inside information on the Lara Bingle?
Look, she's a good route. Yeah. half of Melbourne's had a ride up there, so
a Zombie Horde wants to know what it's like being the second most famous Michael Clark.
It has been handy. I did get into a very nice restaurant in Sydney with the corner table once, and they were clearly disappointed when I showed up. when I booked it, I got in a lot easier than I expected. And they did not get what they expected.
And it seems Smorgan's been throwing a lot of shade in a lot of these questions. He wants to know, how did Michael come up with the Clarky build of Chosen and Bloodstokers when the STD drop book dropped? And then did you sell it to In the Bin or give it to him as charity? And In the Bin is Luke Morton.
Okay. Not quite sure I followed all of that, but it was pretty bloody obvious. Chosen whipped by a Bloodstoker, thrown through a bridge was a pretty good build for a moment in time there. That was a lot of fun, that list. The only one that stopped me was Corey on the way through. It's going into round five at CanCon. I think there was 14 or so 4-0 players, and pretty much it was Corey and Joel are the two that I didn't want. And so I had 12 out of 14 chances to go all the way, and I drew fucking Corey.
It seems you and have a bit of a rivalry at the last game of the tournament.
It's actually only the second tournament time I've played him. So the previous time was a draw in a Doc versus Doc, a outright dead draw game. I've dead drawed against him once and he's beaten me once. So I owe him a loss. I need to take it. He's whipped out of Masters, unfortunately, in some sort of excuses. All I heard is he was too scared to prove that he was the best in a proper competitive field.
And then the last one is from me. We know what you've got ahead in the future with your Masters and Worlds. Is there anything else you have planned tournament-wise? And then also, do you have any shout-outs you wanted to give?
Probably only got those tournaments, and then really keen on Runax, Sydney GT, and the Lost Legion GT. We'll go to a few others through the year. Total focus is really the Worlds, and then Masters is secondary for that. Team Australia wants to go all the way in the Worlds. We want to be podium or even at the top as an ambition. And we're taking a very, very strong team. So we've got lessons learned from last year that we can bake in. And, it's going to be tough and competitive, but green all the way, hopefully.
Yeah, well, I wish you all luck for both of those.
Thanks, man, and thanks for having me on, Sam. So,
No worries. Well, thank you very much for coming on, Clarky. It was great to speak to you. We've spoken a lot in person, but it was nice to sort of get more of a backstory on you as a hobbyist and a wargamer.
Yeah, man, for sure. And look forward to seeing you around Irresistible Force down at Tenamara in
a few weeks. Yes, indeed, indeed. Awesome. Well, have a good rest of your week, mate.
Thanks, mate. Same to you. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Unidentified Wargamer. You can find links for the guests located in the description below. You can find the show on Twitter at @u_wargamer. And I will see you next week.